Football Weekly is on the air.
Peyton will fake to Dominic Rhodes. Looks, looks. Here's one out to Reggie Wayne. Touchdown! The fourth touchdown pass by Peyton Manning.
Jason rolling, going deep.
He's
looking
open.
In. Still Santana there. Touchdown! Touchdown, let's get Santana Moss. 31 yards.
River hands it off. Collinson guns it to the left side, and down the sideline he goes. Midfield, 40, 30, cutback, 20, 15, 10. He is gone! LaDainius Collinson, 85, big one!
Hi, Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm and Mike Wilkening, welcoming you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we go around the NFL and bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors, always fresh and always first.
We'll have the latest on the Michael Vick indictment, plus the market for Dante Culpepper.
It's all right ahead on this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Welcome into this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor, along with my associate editors here in studio, Mike Wilkening and Eric Edholm. And we start the show this week by heading out to the Pro Football Weekly offices and welcoming in another one of our associate editors, Chris Neubauer. And Newby covers the NFC South for us. There reside the Atlanta Falcons, and of course, at least presently with the Atlanta Falcons, Michael Vick. And there obviously is no other story we could start the show with this week. Michael Vick indicted by a federal grand jury earlier this week, basically for involvement in a dogfighting operation known as Bad News Kennels. And Chris, before we get into any kind of speculation or guessing or any kind of discussion at all of what's going to happen to Michael Vick, could just if you set the table on the particulars for us.
Well, on April 25th, the authorities went to property that Michael Vick owned in Virginia on a drug raid. His cousin that was living on the property was in trouble for drug charges, and they stumbled upon the dogfighting operation, and for the past few months have been piecing it together, and now Michael Vick's name came up. He was indicted with three other men in connection with the dogfighting operation. He's charged with two felonies and faces up to 6 years in prison and $350,000 in fines if convicted on both charges. And the federal government has a 95% conviction rate. So if they bring the indictment against you, it's a case they think they are going to win, and they most often do win.
Well, Chris, and we want to be careful here. Yes, all of those things facts, but let's be as clear as possible. Michael Vick has been indicted. He has been charged. We have seen no evidence yet. We've heard from no witnesses. There has been no trial. He is, of course, innocent until proven guilty. I think one of the things that has people around the league really talking about this and pretty much getting ready for the next step, though, is that 95% conviction rate you talk about. Now, 2 weeks ago, there was a bogus report that the feds had announced he wouldn't be indicted, and I heard this, and we started doing some work around PFW. I knew that couldn't be true because the federal government never says they're not going to charge you. They just say they are, and sometimes they threaten to and don't. But now, 2 weeks later, this very serious indictment, any sense from talking to your sources of what happened, what might have changed, what the government might have discovered in the last couple weeks that caused this big turnaround?
Well, in reading the indictment, there are several cooperating witnesses that have issued statements, and they are the ones that are identifying Michael Vick being at at fights and gambling money on these fights and transporting these dogs and conspiring with all the other with his three other associates in the whole dog fighting operation. And his first day in court is set for July 26th, which coincidentally happens to be the first day of Falcons training camp. And he will not be at training camp. He will be in court where he will enter his plea, and then there will be a bond hearing. So, you know, this legal process, while they say the trial probably won't start until sometime in the winter and probably toward the end of the NFL season, he's going to have to make several court appearances during the season, and this is just going to be a huge distraction hanging over his head and over the Falcons' head.
You know, Chris, on Thursday, Arthur Blank, the owner of the Falcons, released a statement that didn't reveal too much. What are your sources and people in Atlanta saying about what Blank is feeling right now? After all, this is an owner who seems to have kind of taken Vick under his wing a little bit, treated him as if he was a member of his family in some regards. He's had a real close relationship, defended him when he's gotten in trouble. Blank has always preached accountability and responsibility in these things. It appears that Vick has kind of undermined that, or at least if he's proven guilty, he has. What do you imagine is going through Blank's mind right now, especially given that he gave him such a large contract?
Well, Blank is crushed right now because, like you said, he's always felt as himself as a kind of father figure toward Vic, and he was the one that pushed for the 10-year, $130 million contract in 2004. What we've heard is that GM Rich McKay was against the move, but Arthur Blank was the one that wanted to show that he takes care of his guys and wanted to come out there with that huge blockbuster deal for Vic. So he's absolutely crushed right now. He's actually out of the country in Africa on a safari when word of the indictment came down. So he's been kind of behind the whole thing a little bit, a few steps behind trying to catch up. But right now I'm sure they're looking into his contract and trying to find out if there's any sort of a loophole where they can cut him. Obviously they'd have to take a $6 million cap hit this year. But, you know, maybe the league would give them a waiver on the cap hit for next year because it's scheduled to be about $15 million. And that's, you know, I'm sure they're looking into all the legal angles that they can to see if they can distance themselves as far away from Vic as possible. Right now, you know, they're issuing, you know, it's half support, half condemning Vic right now because they're saying, you know, obviously he hasn't been convicted of anything. So they are taking their time, just like the league and the Falcons seem to be in unison right now with their statements. Both have said similar things that, you know, we're supporting Michael Vick as much as we can while we gather facts about this case.
Chris, it is pretty clear the NFL could take action against him with the updated personal conduct policy without a conviction. It's pretty clear within the writing of it. But is it the sense that you're getting that they're going to let this play out before anything happens to him?
For now, they are. That's the word out of the league office is that they're going to let the legal process play itself out before they hand down any sort of discipline. But the public pressure is going to be mounting against Roger Goodell and against Arthur Blank to take action against Vic. I know the Humane Society has been very active in pressuring the league and pressuring sponsors. And just today, it was announced that Nike was withholding releasing a new Michael Vick shoe that was planned to be released this summer because of, you know, public pressure. I mean, they're very concerned of the image that Michael Vick is portraying right now, and I think that Goodell and Arthur Blank may be pushed because of all this public pressure, all the protests that are sure to follow the Falcons, you know, at training camp and at games that Vick plays, and I'm sure they're going to feel a lot of pressure to take some action against him.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for your work on that story. I'm sure we'll be checking in regularly over the next couple of weeks. Right now we take a commercial break and then talk about another quarterback on the move, Dante Culpepper, right after this. Hub Arkish, Eric Edholm, and Mike Wilkening bringing you Pro Football Weekly, and we're now joined by managing editor Mike Holbrook, and Mike covers the AFC East for us. And big news out of Miami. It probably should have come, I think we all thought it was coming weeks ago, but it finally happened. The Dolphins have acknowledged, no, nobody's going to trade for Dante Culpepper when they know the Dolphins have no choice but to cut him loose. And so the Dolphins have given Dante Culpepper his release. He is a free agent out there. First, let's wrap up his stay in Miami, where it all went wrong and why this finally comes down now, Mike.
Well, Hub, it went wrong because he only played four games and they paid out $8 million for him. It was not a wise investment. Obviously, he rushed back from his very serious knee injury that he had suffered with Minnesota. Whose fault that was, ultimately, it really hasn't been determined. But the upshot is Cam Cameron and Randy Mueller didn't have any ties to him. That was a Nick Saban move, and they decided that they wanted to go in a different direction. And after trying to trade him for weeks, they realized that there was no market for him. Most teams thought that he would get cut just like he was, and so they decided to make the move this week because they realized that it was getting close to training camp, and they want it to be as quiet, controversy-wise, training camp as can be. And this is Cam Cameron's first training camp as head coach. Try to get rid of any kind of controversy that they can, and so that's why the move was made now.
Well, and the last interesting piece is Dante Culpepper and the NFL Players Association had filed a grievance against the Dolphins. They purposely canceled a hearing, I believe, last week, had another one scheduled for next week. And their position, or at least Dick Bertelsen, the chief counsel for the NFLPA, says that their position was that you can't keep the guy under contract and not allow him to compete for a job when there are incentive clauses in his bonus and the right to earn a living. Dolphins felt that they had a pretty good position on it, but obviously didn't choose to risk that with an arbitrator. So what do we hear now? Going into this decision earlier this week, we had heard that if and when he was available, that certainly Jacksonville, possibly Baltimore, and possibly St. Louis could be suitors. And now, is there a market in Atlanta?
Yeah, there could be, Hub. This Michael Vick situation certainly has the Falcons reevaluating their quarterback situation. They did bring in Joey Harrington, but he proved last year in Miami that he is a limited quarterback and I don't think ready to be a starter again in the league. You know, Matt Schaub was traded away. There's lots of second-guessing going on in Atlanta now after they made that move before all of this dogfighting information came out and was leaked out. So, yes, I think there's a serious consideration being given to Culpepper in Atlanta, and I don't think he's going to be out of work that long.
You know, Mike, the message that came from Cam Cameron and Randy Mueller when they went in a different direction at quarterback was basically that, you know, we think that somebody else will be a better fit in this offense. Do you get any indication they just think that Culpepper is completely cooked, that he has no potential left? I mean, that seems to be the statement they're making by releasing him.
You're right, Eric, and I can tell you that talking to sources in South Florida, that's a little bit of a touchy subject with players on the Dolphins team. They saw how hard Culpepper was working to rehab his knee. They saw him in the weight room early and for long hours all off season. They saw him trying to get back onto the field. He has not gone through a full practice since prior to week 5 last year, and so he's still got a ways to go, but there are players in that locker room that wish he had been given an opportunity to compete for the job, and the coaching staff and Randy Mueller just decided they didn't even want to deal with him.
Getting away from Dante Culpepper for a second, you know, you talk to people down there all the time in Miami. Expectations for that offense now that Trent Green is in place, they drafted John Beck. It seems from an outsider's perspective that they've put together a pretty interesting offense there.
Absolutely, Mike, and they wanted to get faster, and they've done that not only with Ted Ginn, and it remains to be seen how much he'll be able to contribute as a receiver, but he will be available and out on the field. David Martin, they believe, gives them a speed factor at the tight end position that can give them some mismatches down the field. Lorenzo Booker's a guy that they think is going to be a real fast change of pace back to Ronnie Brown, and even on the offense. Offensive line. They just signed their second-round pick, Samson Satele, from Hawaii. He's a quick pulling guard that they can do more things with their offensive line. And so I think the speed factor is going to be the big one for them. And they hope with a veteran quarterback in Trent Green that he'll be able to utilize all those weapons and they'll be able to be much more effective offensively than they were in Nick Saban's 2 years.
Certainly the hope. They're going to need to do more on that offensive line than just bring in the second-round rookie before the rest of it gets fixed. And the DUI from Chris Chambers earlier this week, probably not a happy distraction, especially with Cam Cameron as the head coach. And, Mike, quickly, before we let you go, one other club in your division, New England Patriots, been making news all offseason. Kind of a feel-good story this week. After all the big-name acquisitions, they bring back one of their own. Tell us what went on there.
Yeah, Mr. Patriot is back on the team. Troy Brown, the wide receiver / defensive back / punt returner, does it all, and I think that's the big reason, Hub, why he was brought back. They trust him to do those many different things. He's in his 15th year. He's been with the program, knows what it's all about, and Tom Brady trusts him implicitly when he's out on the field as a wide receiver. I don't know how much time he's going to get as a wide receiver this year with all the talent they have there, but there will be a role for him on the team, and he'll be there as a mentor and guide and a fallback option.
You know, you have to wonder, as you look at that roster, because Troy Brown is going to be there, but with Dante Stallworth and Randy Moss and Wes Welker and the first-round pick last year, Chad Jones, all the bodies they've got there, is Troy Brown going to be given a wide receiver roster spot, or is it going to be a defensive back's roster spot? We'll remain to be seen. We've got to take another commercial break here, but lots more NFL Way We Hear It coming up right after this. Back with more NFL Way We Hear It here on Pro Football Weekly. Hub Arkish, Eric Edholm, Mike Wilkening here in studio with you. And we go to the NFC North. Our home base is Chicago. We've been talking about the Chicago Bears all year long. This is not a huge story, Wilkie, but the deadline, July 16th, for NFL players with franchise tags to sign long-term contracts. The two who didn't, Lance Briggs in Chicago, Asante Samuel in New England, now cannot sign a long-term deal with anybody until the new free agency period begins next February. We knew this was going to happen, and yet people in Chicago still acting surprised. What's next with Lance Briggs and the Bears?
Hard to say, but I would tend to think that it would behoove Briggs to sign his tender, get into camp, because If he were to hold out, the type of fines he's going to rack up, the type of game checks he would forfeit if he were to hold out into the season, that would be money that one might argue might never make back. And I tend to think that he'll enhance his value if he's on the field. And at this point, without the ability to talk about an extension, with only the ability to sign that tender, to not talk extension until the end of the regular season, really, I think it's a situation where at some point it's going to come to him that, hey, got to come in, prove it that, you know, my market value, you know, is what I think it's going to be next offseason when the cap goes up to $116 million. And if he doesn't have a future in Chicago, and it gets hard to say if he'll be back or not, certainly somebody you would think is going to pay him the type of money, at least close to what he's seeking. So I think getting into camp is the best move for him at this point.
Well, and it is a little unclear as to how much the Bears can, will, or should fine him, the vagaries of this situation, since he has not signed the tender offer yet. But the bottom line is that for each regular season game he misses, with the threat to sit out 10 games and still get a season of vesting coming back for week 11, would cost him $400,000. Now, this is a player who's never made $7 million in a season. That's money you never get back. And so the Bears have clearly won this one, as have the Patriots with Asante Samuel. These guys will show up. The story to watch in Chicago, Lance Briggs has a habit of not necessarily being in the best shape when he shows up in training camp. If he now decides to sit out part of training camp and show up late, how many times have we seen it? These players get mad, they get angry, they come back, they get injured, and the season is a waste anyway. In Detroit, though, Eric, a little bit different story. Corey Redding, who came on huge last year for them as Sean Rogers, their more highly rated and better known defensive tackle, was injured much of the year, gets the richest contract ever given to a defensive tackle in the NFL, allegedly worth $49 million over the life of the deal. This for a young man who some people were surprised he was franchised because he's not the biggest name on the team.
Yeah, guys like Tommy Harris got to love this, sitting back and watching this. I mean, this is great news for any impending free agent at defensive tackle. You know, I think the hope in Detroit was, you know, start up front, let's build a team from the line out. And Rod Marinelli clearly placed a lot of value on his front four being able to create pressure. You know, you look at a per game basis, those 8 sacks that Redding had in 11 games, that's pretty darn good, especially for an interior player. I mean, I guess the hope is that Redding can make Rodgers a better player, keep him motivated, keep him focused and on target. But that's a lot of money to be a motivator as well as a pretty good player. So it's an expensive contract and it's a big deal. We'll see if it pays out.
And here's another, I think, deal, guys, where people say that's a lot of money for that player. But again, you have to look at the economic situation.
Yeah.
League right now with the cap increasing the way it is, if you wait with somebody like Corey Redding, and you mentioned 11 games only in the interior, 8 sacks, pass rushers like that inside you don't see very often. If he has a season similar to that, what's his value next year? Does it cost you $60 million and 25 guaranteed to get it done? I think the Lions made the right move here.
Well, and the other piece of it, guys, is if you understand how these contracts work, yeah, it's a $49 million deal.
Right.
But he won't have received half of it before this deal gets redone again. Yeah. So we have no idea. I mean, the 15-20 is great money for this kid. He's going to get that. The rest remains to be seen. While we're in the NFC North, guys, the Minnesota Vikings, the hell is this team thinking? They're going to camp with Tavarius Jackson and Brooks Bollinger as their quarterbacks. Mike, they had given the job to Tavarius Jackson, the second-round pick last year, who some people thought was a huge reach in the second round. He's had a terrible offseason, so now they're forced into an open quarterback competition. Brooks Bollinger, the guy who's supposed to compete for the job, this is a team whose biggest offensive weapon is going to be rookie running back Adrian Peterson. It looked, for all the world, when Brad Childress was the first of 10 new head coaches hired last year, like new owner Ziggy Wilf knew what he was doing. This organization has looked silly pretty much ever since.
And the reason why they've maybe looked silly to some people is that look at the situation at quarterback and look at the situation at wide receiver. I think we also have to look at that closely. Who's their number one receiver right now? Troy Williamson? You know, clearly has not proven himself maybe to be the type of player they thought he was going to be. They're going to really lean on Sidney Rice, the second round pick. You know, it's going to make it hard on either quarterback that gets into the lineup. We know from watching Bollinger in New York, this is somebody that has struggled when given a chance to play extended minutes. He's more of a backup type. Jackson, I think his physical tools are exciting. He has done some nice things in flashes when you've kind of looked at him. But again, the fact that they give him the job, and, you know, we're hearing reports that he's struggling, it's not a good start. You don't want a quarterback controversy at this point. You don't want an open competition for Minnesota. You want the guy you handpicked to sort of ascend into the role, get comfortable, experience the growing pains there, not on the practice field in June and July.
You know, guys, there were two things we knew about Tavares Jackson when they drafted him in the second round last year. Pretty much every other team in the league said, gee, we might have taken him in the fourth or
fourth,
fifth.
Yep.
You know, nice prospect. But the second thing that everybody else agreed on, a 3-4, maybe 5-year project. How do you go into the offseason of his second season handing him the job? They have gotten exactly what they deserve. We will take another commercial break. Lots more NFL Way We Hear It coming up right after this. Indeed we are. Hub Arkish, Eric Edholm, and Mike Wilkening bringing you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, and it's wall-to-wall Way We Hear It as we find ourselves just 1 week away from training camps opening around the National Football League. Plenty of news and a lot more coming. We now move to Eric's division, the NFC East, the Dallas Cowboys, a team a lot of folks have talked about during the offseason, Eric, and I, for one, am a little puzzled as to why. I don't think they're as good as they were at the end of last season when they weren't that good. There's other people predicting great things for them. Right now, a lot of the focus, though, on linebacker Greg Ellis was having a huge year last year until he suffered a season-ending Achilles injury. Now, not yet cleared to play by team doctors. Have to wonder where he fits in the Cowboys' plans.
Yeah, absolutely. He has not been cleared yet. So, I mean, as of now, Anthony Spencer, another converted defensive end. Remember, Ellis was a down lineman at one point in his career. Spencer, you know, a guy who's never really played linebacker before, has been running with the first team, and that makes you question a couple of things. Number one, how far along is he? He's looked okay in drills, according to people we've talked to in Dallas, and nimble enough and able to pull those things off. But what about Bobby Carpenter? Why isn't he factoring in there? He's a guy that seemed to be playing well by the end of the year, and right now he's backing up in the inside. So with Ellis and the Achilles injury, sort of an unknown. They go into camp with one of their prime pass rushing spots a question. And I think this is a defense that will produce more big plays. I think you're going to see Ken Hamlin is that deep safety guy, kind of keep Roy Williams up in the box a little bit more. I think that Wade Phillips is going to be able to do similar things to what he did in San Diego and attack upfield more, less two-gap principles and more one-gap, more slanting, and that allowed those guys to have quite a few sacks in San Diego last year, whereas in Dallas, they were asked to kind of hold the point a little bit more and be, up front. And I think this defense fits the personnel a little bit better with 7 former first-round picks.
Eric, in addition to your duties on the NFC East, you, of course, also cover the Tennessee Titans for us. And this offseason, you've been the leading man in this program as we get our Pac-Man Jones update almost every week. But we'll get to Pac-Man in just a minute. I want to talk about another situation in Tennessee where Jeff Fisher, interestingly enough, I would say arguably if not the most respected, certainly one of the most respected head coaches in the National Football League, is heading into a lame duck season. And, there was talk last year prior to Floyd Reese either being fired or quitting that there was a split between Jeff Fisher and Reese, who'd been so successful together, over the decision to draft Vince Young over Matt Leinart. Now, obviously, the Young decision worked out okay. Reese has moved on. But now you've got Fisher, and you have to wonder, they're happy with Young. Why would they even allow him to consider going into a lame duck season?
Well, yeah, I mean, so far that is what's happening. And all sides say that, everything's okay. And owner Bud Adams made a statement, saying that everything was fine with the situation. Jeff Fisher this past week basically said that he's not concerned about the deal, but there is still a lack of a contract past this season. And, look at the strides the team made last year. They've got a young quarterback. They've made some improvements. They've been active in free agency the last 2 years. So, this is a team that a lot of people think is on the upswing, and yet they have a situation with their coach that they don't know yet. So there are some people. The people I've talked to, though, have said it's not as big a concern as it may appear. I tend to think that there is some news there, and that nothing has gotten done yet.
And we can't get through a week without the Pac-Man Jones update. And this one, to me, is a very strange story. His agent, Michael Hague, came out last week and said that part of the understanding that he had and that Pac-Man Jones had was that when he dropped his appeal of his 1-year suspension, that the league would be forced to or would allow him to participate in training camp and even preseason games. We know Chris Henry is going to be able to do that with his 8-game suspension in Cincinnati. Gene Upshaw, the head of the NFL Players Association, has confirmed that was his understanding as well. But one thing that I'm hearing loud and clear out of Tennessee, I don't think the Titans want him anywhere near training camp if the guy's suspended for the year. I don't understand what the point would be. So what's really going on here?
Yeah, I mean, everybody from the front office, you know, they asked some players, Kyle VandenBosch considered kind of a leader on the team, you know, whether Pac-Man Jones' presence during training camp practices would be a distraction. They said, you know, we think it might be. And I think the Titans view this as, considering all they've done to repair the cornerback position in the offseason, you know, they're very likely moving beyond Pac-Man Jones. So having him there in camp as, if you want to say, a lame duck player in a certain way of light, you know, that's definitely going to be a distraction. Do you put him on the first team? Do you give him any reps at all with the defense? You know, how do you divvy it up, especially with so many new faces at cornerback? So, you know, this is a weird story, and it appears that, you know, Goodell maybe, you know, left out the fact that I believe the preseason games are off. I don't think those are part of the equation, but the practices definitely are. In Chris Henry's case, talking about the Bengals, Chris Henry, now the Titans, of course, he had a specific stipulation about training camp practice, whereas in Jones's case, he did not. Now, he could come back after 10 games. That just appears really unlikely at this point.
Mike Wilkin, of course, covers the AFC North for us. And, Wilkie, quickly before we go to break, a story out of Pittsburgh that I know you've been all over. Alan Faneca, the All-Pro guard, apparently has said that he expects this to be his last season in Pittsburgh. He is upset about the lack of any progress on a new contract, wants a contract extension, was very clear that he was disappointed that Russ Grimm and Ken Wisenhunt had moved on, that Mike Tomlin got the head coaching job. What do you really make of this story?
Oh, I make of the fact that, you know, really, Alan Faneca, I think, wants to be paid like a top three or top four player at his position. You know, one of the top players in general, without getting specific about numbers. And you look at the deals that a Derek Dockery gets from Buffalo, $49 million, $18.5 million guaranteed. You know, Alan Faneca is probably one of the three, four best guards in the game. And he's, you know, he is going to be 30 years old. But it's clear that this is probably his last big payday. And I think that it's not going to come probably in Pittsburgh, or at least at this point that it hasn't come, is of disappointment to him. If this is a negotiation ploy and it works out for him, wonderful. If not, you have to wonder why he would play this sort of ploy right now, because, again, it just sort of, you know, brings to light all sorts of issues that he's going to have to talk about all season.
Well, one of the things we know about the history of the Pittsburgh Steelers, very few veterans get their last big payday in free agency when it comes to the Steelers. We've got more NFL Way We Hear It and some very special fantasy football talk up next. Well, with training camps just a week away, as we said last segment, we now have to start our focus on fantasy football as well, and we welcome in Trent Modlin. Trent is our associate editor, not only in charge of the AFC West, but one of our fantasy experts at Pro Football Weekly. And Trent, you know, I think the first question I want to focus on this year, free agency. You know, we know that it's a big deal for teams when they bring in big-time free agents. What free agents come to your mind who might have a bigger impact on fantasy football because of their new situation?
You know, Hubbard, two kind of seem to, you know, rise to the top of the list. I mean, there are a number of guys that move, probably about 10 or 12 that have a serious fantasy impact. But I kind of target Travis Henry and Randy Moss as the top of that list. I mean, Henry is he moves from Tennessee to Denver. He's a perfect fit for that Denver system, a very proven system in terms of rushing the football over the years. He's a perfect fit, kind of a bruising downhill runner. And Mike Shanahan has been looking for that bell cow back to kind of move the chains in the fourth quarter for many years now. He's finally got him in Travis Henry. He's not going to come off the field. And Denver's reputation, you know, in moving the football on the ground is reason enough to consider Henry in the first round. And, of course, Randy Moss. I mean, you know, Randy is finally relevant again on the fantasy scene. It seemed like 2 years he spent in Oakland, he was just an enigma of sorts. And, you know, he gives Tom Brady, along with Dante Stallworth and Wes Welker, who should not be forgotten about, he gives Tom Brady the best surrounding cast that he's ever had. I mean, the key for Moss, I think, clearly is his focus and attitude, which were, you know, definite trouble spots in Oakland. And it really made it difficult to tell if he'd truly lost a step or not, as some scouts suggest.
I'll throw one more old face in a new place at you, and Willis McGahee here. And here's a guy who I guess is still young enough to be considered a potential guy, and yet he moves from Buffalo to Baltimore. Baltimore, a place where we, you know, they made some strides offensively last year, but I just can't get the image of that playoff performance against the Colts out of my head, and just the offensive ineptitude that they put forth. Obviously, their real talent lies somewhere in between there and what they did during the regular season, I think. But what can we realistically expect out of McGahee? Where does he fit in the running back tier, and how do you view his 2007 prospects?
Eric, I think he's probably right in the number two running back section. Kind of a solid pick, but maybe one that has a ceiling a little bit. The Baltimore did lose two of its starting offensive linemen in the offseason. Steve McNair has dropped off a bit as he continues to age at the quarterback position. And I think Willis McGahee, we saw him come back from the knee injury, but then he went through a little bit of a lull in Buffalo, and I think it's a much better system in Baltimore that he's stepping into. But I think there is a limit, a ceiling of sorts on what we can expect. I think he's locked probably for 1,000 yards, but if you're going to expect double-digit touchdowns, that may be a bit much. A couple other guys on this list that I've really targeted is Thomas Jones with the Jets, automatic 15 to 18 carries as the bona fide starter there. But watch out, Leon Washington could be a third down option there. Amon Green moves from Green Bay to Houston. A bit of a blocking problem in Houston in the past, but he's also past his prime. But he could be a serviceable number three fantasy back. Tatum Bell in Detroit. I mentioned Dante Stallworth and Wes Welker. And two quarterbacks, Trent Green, Jeff Garcia, and I'm going to throw a third in there. Matt Schaub with the Houston Texans finally gets his chance.
Trent, in this last minute or so as we wrap up this segment, Garcia's effect on the Buccaneers offense, I know he's probably going to be drafted as a backup in most formats, but it seems to me that he might be a guy that has more of an effect on his supporting cast than maybe his own numbers, meaning he might be a guy that throws, 18 touchdowns, runs for a couple or something, but the effect that he might have on, say, a Cadillac Williams, who was drafted as a number one or a number two back last year in many formats, didn't play up to that. The effect he might have on Joey Galloway, maybe Michael Clayton, Maurice Stalvall, what type of effect do you think Garcia's going to have on that offense?
I think he's just going to bring balance is the big thing. I mean, Cadillac Williams has seen a lot of safeties creep up into the box and last couple years. He's been dinged up as well, but I think that Jeff Garcia, we saw him put up some pretty big numbers and when he rescued the Eagles season last year. It wasn't like he was just guiding the ship. I mean, he put up some decent passing numbers, so I think he can still get it done, but it's always been a run-first team with John Gruden, so I think his chances downfield will be limited a little bit, but I think he means a lot to Cadillac Williams and Joey Galloway especially, and it sounds like Maurice Stovall is moving up that depth chart pretty quickly at the wide receiver spot.
All right, Trent, we need to take a commercial break here, but we're going to come back in a minute and take a look at some fantasy studs who haven't moved, but who you may want to be careful with for one reason or another. We're kicking off the fantasy football season as well right here at Pro Football Weekly. Again, training camp's just a week away. You guys start to do your scouting, get ready for your drafts, get ready for your fantasy football season. Trent Modlin is associate editor at Pro Football Weekly, joins Eric Edholm and Mike Wilkening. I'm Hub Arkish. We're here in studio talking fantasy football. And Trent, you got to look around the league. Now, everybody has got to identify certain guys who are those top 10, those top 15 guys, fantasy stickouts, guys you're excited about. I'm looking for the guys who maybe, even though you would think is a slam dunk top 5, top 10 pick, you might want to be a little careful with this year. And I want to get your opinion on the guy who heads up my list. I look at Larry Johnson in Kansas City, and we all know what a fantasy producer he's been the last couple of years. But I see a guy with over 800 carries on his body in just two seasons. The offensive line has disappeared. It looks like Brody Croyle at quarterback. I can give you a lot of reasons why I'd be careful if I had one of the first two or three picks in my draft if I was going to use it on Larry Johnson.
Yeah, I think you're right, Hub. I mean, this is a guy who you could pretty much pencil him in for well over 1,000 yards and probably double-digit touchdowns. But the key thing is he going to live up to the potential that, he's raised the bar so high in his first 2 years as a starter that can he live up to that as the offense goes through a real progression? They've gotten more conservative with Herm Edwards. The offensive line, as you mentioned, you lose two future Hall of Famers in the last couple years. And you've got a first-time starting quarterback probably in Brody Croyle. I think that all that is going to weigh him down a lot, and you got to think too that he's going to be he might not have focus at the beginning of the season if this contract situation lingers into to week one and beyond. So a lot of things are kind of dragging him down a little bit. He's right at the number two or three spot. We've kind of gone back and forth with him and Steven Jackson on our draft board behind LaDainian Tomlinson, and it's a toss-up. But I'll tell you what, it'd be hard pressed to see him match his numbers of the last couple years, I think.
Trent, the question I would have for you is this. It seems to me this year that there maybe is as much bust potential at the top of drafts as we've seen for the reasons we talked about with Larry Johnson. Another guy that stands out to me is Sean Alexander, considering the foot injury last year, considering the workload he had when he came back from injury in the playoffs. If you go back and look, he was worked as hard as Johnson, if not harder. And given his age, given the fact that, you know, maybe he's not quite as quick as he was a couple years ago, you know, I mean, he's somebody that's probably going to go in the top 10 of drafts. Does that seem that way to you, that when you look at some of these top picks, you know, Frank Gore is a guy that is probably going to go in the top 10 of drafts, but he has an injury history. You know, doesn't it seem like to you that maybe this is more volatile a season than we've seen in some time?
Yeah, I think so, and I think that is part of the reason is that the numbers have been so consistent for these guys over the years. You really look at the top 10 of each, there just seems to be so much more depth, but when you look a little bit closer, there are some major red flags with some of these players. And you mentioned Sean Alexander, you know, age has creeped up, the heavy workload over the years. He says he's healthy and that, you know, no ill effects from that cracked bone in his foot, but you have to wonder if time has finally caught up with him. And Frank Gore, the injury history, was relied on so much last year. I think a lot of people are going to reach for him. It wouldn't surprise me to see some people take him fourth overall based on his potential and what the 49ers have done in free agency. But there are a number of guys, I think, that, you know, have that bust potential. But some of them are the aging, you know, guys that we've relied on over the years. The Steve McNairs, the Warwick Dunns, Jamal Lewis has come to mind, even Fred Taylor. I mean, Taylor had a quiet 1,000-yard season last year, but, you know, as Maurice Jones-Drew really stole the spotlight, and when the Jags go to throw or even get near the goal line, it's not going to be Fred Taylor on the field. And that's the kind of thing you have to look for as we get into training camp, is what role these players, especially veterans, guys that, you know, even have the potential to be cut because of salary cap concerns and age. You just have to look and see what kind of role they're going to play on their respective teams.
Trent, we've only got about 20, 25 seconds left, but you left off a guy who I find myself wondering about. If you don't draft him, you look like a fool when he's the best receiver in football again. But how much longer can Marvin Harrison put up the kind of numbers he's been putting up?
I tell you what, we have him number one on our wide receiver board, and you just can't deny him his due. I mean, he's just as automatic as they come in fantasy football, and he takes great care of his body. And the just kind of that intuition he has with Peyton Manning, I think that you have to continue to have him among your elite wide receivers, at least in the top five. And until he shows that little slip in his play, I'm going to keep putting him up there.
All right, Trent, thank you very much. Next week, we start a series of Trent Modlin's position-by-positions rankings. Right now, we take another commercial break.
The Publisher's Pen, with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Habarkish.
Mike, thank you very much. And it's kind of hard to imagine talking about anything else in the NFL this week except for the indictment and the charges that came down against Michael Vick earlier this week. And one of the things that we're going to be doing at Pro Football Weekly over the next couple of weeks until a trial begins and until more information comes out is reminding everybody with every opportunity that we have, he has been charged. He has been indicted. He has not been tried. He is innocent until proven guilty. That's the way it's supposed to work in this country, and that's the way it should work with Michael Vick. The problem with this particular situation is that Vick has been adamant from the beginning that he's had nothing to do with dogfighting, no connection whatsoever. The whole thing was bogus. And it's a little hard for us to imagine that this is a complete frame job by the federal government. Now, I will tell you that federal prosecutors, from our experience, take a little bit more leeway. They can do things that wouldn't happen possibly in a state or a civil court. But the bottom line is they didn't make this up. Obviously, Michael Vick has had some association or affiliation with Bad News Kennels and dogfighting. Again, I really hope they find the young man innocent, because these charges are just horrific. And if he is guilty, as far as I'm concerned, they can, you know, lock him up and throw away the key. But again, for now, he is innocent. I think the point that people better start to realize, though, he is almost certainly done as an Atlanta Falcon. They can't keep him around this year once the trials start and the distractions coming hot and heavy. And so I would think that Michael Vick's career in Atlanta is over. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, our producer and engineer, Matt Smith, our executive producer, Syndication Network, our home studio. Most of all, our thanks to all of you. Talk to you next week on Pro Football Weekly.